This is Christy Drutman, and you are listening to Brown Girl Green, where I interview environmental leaders and advocates about the importance of justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion, as well as creative solutions to the climate crisis. I'm working to change the image of what it means to be an environmentalist in the 21st century. So it was really important for me to cover SIDS on Brown Girl Green because I feel that a lot of these island states aren't given the proper media or broadcast time to really tell their stories about their vulnerabilities when it comes to the climate crisis. So I'm really excited to have a friend and inspiration of mine, Jeremy, on the show today. He is an incredible leader from the Seychelles, which is one of the island states included on our list. And he's an alumnus of the Alliance of Small Island States Fellowship and served as the Seychelles' permanent mission to the United Nations Climate Change and Ocean Advisory throughout 2022, participating in climate change and high seas negotiations. He is also incredibly decorated with his academic career. He has a Bachelor of Social Science in International Relations and Environmental Geographical Sciences and Bachelor of Social Science in International Relations from the University of Cape Town, a Diploma in Environmental Management from the Technical University of Dresden, and he is currently pursuing a Master's of Public Administration in Environmental Science and Policy at Columbia. For negotiating international environmental law on behalf of Seychelles, small island developing in African states, Jeremy worked with the Seychelles Island Foundation for over 5 years, coordinating the foundation's projects such as the Aldabra Cleanup Project and communications while contributing to national policy focused on climate change, biodiversity, and ocean conservation, as well as environmental impact assessments. He has done incredible work as a youth activist, and being able to represent people from small island developing states, Africa, and the global south overall. I'm like so excited to have him on the show because he not only brings, you know, that perspective of coming from one of these states, but he really understands what it's like to be in these negotiation rooms with all these bureaucratic stakeholders that silence the voices of a lot of people that come from these, you know, nation states. And I think it's so important that he is bringing a voice and a platform that says, no, we aren't going to stand by, be viewed as victims. We are, you know, shaping the narrative for future generations that these are places that are sacred, worth protecting, and worth fighting for. So stick around, listen to this incredible conversation, and make sure that you click subscribe to the Brown Girl Green podcast. So let's dive in and take a listen. What's up, everyone? So excited to have Jeremy on the show today, and we are going to be talking all about SIDS, or Small Island Developing States. So I would love if you could start off by introducing yourself.
Yeah, hi, my name's Jeremy. I'm from Seychelles, a small African island state in the Western Indian Ocean right next to Madagascar. Mm. And I'm currently doing my master's in public administration, environmental science and policy. And before that, I was involved with conservation in Seychelles for about 5 years, project management, communications. And after that, involved with the Alliance of Small Island States, doing negotiations around the High Seas Treaty, as well as the climate change treaties, UNFCCC, Paris Agreement.
Amazing, amazing. And, you know, your work is global and very, you know, impressive. And, you know, I want you to define for this audience, what are small island developing states? Like, what defines them? What kind of forms their identity? And obviously, there's like these bigger alliances. Could you speak a little bit more on how that has formed like an even bigger like collective identity of that group?
No, I really appreciate the chance to shine a light on these tiny countries, like micro. And so in the UN, there's about 39 members of states, you could say. Some of them, like Niue and Cook Islands, they're part of New Zealand in a certain way, or they have some sense of self-governance in that sense. So it's quite interesting. But yeah, 39 UN members. And a lot of them in the Pacific, a lot of people know the Fiji or Samoa, the Federated States of Micronesia. A lot of them also in the Caribbean. So we're talking Antigua and Barbuda, Trinidad and Tobago. And then others are what we call the ASO, the Atlantic, Indian Ocean, South China Sea. So like, funny enough, Singapore is also one. Obviously, Seychelles, Maldives. You can go to Sao Tomo Principe. These are Cape Verde. So these is a quite an eclectic group of countries, but we're all quite similar in the sense of being very small in terms of landmass, very remote in many cases, cut off by, you know, the ocean. We tend to call these things special circumstances. And so these special circumstances are almost structural in saying, okay, because you have small land, small populations, things like economies of scale is hard to produce. When it comes to taking part in negotiations, we'll send maybe 5 people. Mm. Other countries will send 100, depending on, you know, the level of wealth that a country has. So we're this very weird kind of children of the UN that are the tiniest in a sense. We're only about 65 million in total.
Wow.
And I think, you know, when it comes to the big issues, whether it's climate change, whether it's plastic pollution, we're disproportionately affected because, you know, you think about the emissions that all of the cities are putting out. It barely gets to 0.000, doesn't matter, you know, in a sense of that. So we're really impacted by what happens in other countries, even though we're far away from them.
Yeah. And I mean, there was literally just an article that just came out today about the Marshall Islands and what just happened. You know, we're hearing a lot in the news over the past few years, many disasters, whether it be floods, tsunamis, etc., impacting SIDS all over the world. So I want to dive a bit deeper into climate vulnerability of SIDS. Like, from what you've been saying, you know, you talked about the economic, you know, impacts or vulnerabilities of a lot of these countries. What are other factors that make them particularly vulnerable to the impacts of climate change?
Yeah, so when you're talking about the Marshall Islands specifically, and I'm someone who's not yet visited the Pacific, but would really love to. But when we're thinking about the Marshall Islands, Kiribati, Tuvalu, and Maldives, these are all low-lying, really low-lying, coralline atolls countries. And in a sense, we're talking in the American context, I think like 3 feet above sea level. Mm. And maybe the highest elevation is maybe about 20, 30 feet elevation. And so these countries are really, really affected by sea level rise. So we're talking about coastal erosion, but also submergence. So we're already seeing king tides completely flood the runways, you know, really causing really extreme damage to a country. But we're also so we'd call this like slow onset events in that sense.
Okay.
And that would also include your erosion and all these other things that happen over time. But then we have more extreme weather events, so hurricanes. And so the Pacific, that also is a case, but I'm more familiar with the Caribbean in a sense. So I'll know, like with Dominica, they had a hurricane, I believe, in 2017. They lost 224% of their GDP overnight. I mean, if we can try and put that in a U.S. Figure, that would be like losing $42 trillion overnight.
Wow.
So you can't really come back from that because you're kind of remote, you're kind of by yourself.
Wow.
So if you're a country like this, you're extremely small and vulnerable. There's things like where Seychelles finds itself in. So we're not like those 4 countries I mentioned, like Kiribati or Marshall Islands, all just low-lying. We have some granitic islands, about 42 of them, and about 73 of them are coralline, like as other countries. So we'll be impacted by sea level rise, we'll be impacted by coastal erosion, but it'll be in a sense one where we're being damaged over time, where a lot of people in Seychelles, we live on 3 main islands. The main one, Mahé, where I'm from, is about 77,000 people. And a lot of our people, 40,000, are living by the coast, but our critical infrastructure, so our utilities, road, airports, ports, everything we're doing is really on the coast. So they'll be impacted by things like coastal erosion. But even more interesting or less known and understood by people is, for instance, if your economy is really dependent on tuna, as ours is, and now because of sea temperature changes, the tuna migration changes and it doesn't go through your waters. Those tuna don't end up on our ports in that sense. And if in our case, tuna accounts for 80% of our hard exports, you can see the cost of living really increase. So there's direct impacts from hurricanes, from sea level rise, but then these other impacts also affect people's cost of living and ability to aspire to have a life on these islands.
In my research, it showed that, like, definitely during COVID and the pandemic, obviously a lot of these countries rely heavily on tourism. Yes. And obviously, like, you know, even with the impacts of the pandemic, trying to recover from that on top of things like natural disasters, like it's like one thing after another just layers on top of them, you know.
It's a bit of being on sandcastles in a sense. And as you mentioned, it's really, really well said, because I think of tourism indirectly, totally, it comes from something like 70% of our economy. So for about we made sure we were some of the first countries to be vaccinated and open our borders again, because immediately foreign exchange is gone, immediately the cost of living goes up. And so exactly these external shocks really have an impact on us. And, you know, it's interesting, again, when we think about history, when we think about Seychelles being a country that was, quote unquote, discovered by the Portuguese. It's been on Arab maps beforehand. It was settled by the French. They bought slaves over. The English and French fought over a while. So it's a quite interesting story where people have been, in many cases, brought against their will. And I know this is very much the case in other small island states in Africa and the Caribbean. And now we're kind of being pushed off against our will again, in a sense. So there's a discussion about how vulnerable we are and why we are there in the first place.
Yeah. And from what you've observed, like in the Seychelles and other places, like what are the impacts on like cultural identity and, you know, like the threats to just cultural heritage practices that you're seeing from things like, you know, the climate crisis?
Yeah, I think from climate crisis is less so in a sense of like how it's impeding us. But I think fishermen will have an impact because in a day, and, you know, the climate is one of these threats, right? You've got overfishing that may be happening, all these other things happening. And I think it's a cumulative impact, right? And so I think when we look at maybe people directly affected in the next couple of years and decades, fishermen are definitely going to be part of that. I think anybody connected to nature is really going to be impacted. And I think what's a bigger impact from what I'm seeing right now is tourism, in a sense.
Yeah.
So how do you have sustainable and responsible tourism is also a question. And I think we want to maintain our culture, but not just to commercialize it, not just to commodify it, in a sense, for when, you know, we only dance when tourists are around, or we only sell products for tourists and we don't use them at home.
Right.
So I think that's something we're you know, dealing with. And I'm happy to see people my age and younger still keeping dances alive, still keeping music alive. They're not the majority, but they are keeping, you know, I would say momentum and growth for themselves alive.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. I think, I mean, obviously, like, you know, the Philippines isn't necessarily like grouped into that, but I would say it's a very similar thing, like that I experienced like in the Philippines. It's like it's such a resource rich country, but yet export way more than like, you know, we actually like utilize like in the Philippines. And it's really interesting because it's just a similar thing where it's like keeping cultural traditions alive when like we live in such like a globalized society that's trying to push away a lot of those cultural identities and traditions. It's like really interesting, especially when you're trying to like protect a place.
That's it. Yeah, I think it's, you know, you have for Seychelles, you know, we have about before COVID about 400,000 people visiting. So that's like we have a population of just over 100,000. And so when you have that many tourists coming in, we kind of understand in a sense, okay, this is income. But unless you leave the country, like I was lucky enough to live about 4 years in South Africa, travel quite a bit, and now living in the US, I think it's easy to take things for granted in a sense when you're living on a small island. And I don't know if this is the same in the Philippines, but I think obviously it's such a bigger country in a sense. And I think that's the thing, when you realize, oh, that beach used to be empty, you used to have it completely for yourself, or you used to do certain things a certain way as a kid, now you no longer see it. You don't realize these things are day by day changing, year by year, becoming a not a completely different country, but it's harder to keep that connection with what your parents knew, what your grandparents did.
That's really interesting. So I really want to talk about, you know, if a lot of these like SIDS are very vulnerable to the impacts of climate change, it's really important to me to talk about like what are the opportunities to give them a seat at the table. And you have really dove into like what does it mean to have a meaningful seat at the table in a lot of these forums and spaces representing, you know, your community and other island states. And so I wanted to know a little bit more on, you know, your experience with that fellowship with AOSIS and just like how you cultivated your leadership and became you, I guess, in a lot of ways of like stepping into wanting to represent and really advocate for SIDS on a global scale.
Yeah, I think it's I was really lucky to have some mentorship and some friends who had gone through the AOSIS fellowship. And just to give some background on that, so it's about a year-long fellowship where you're basically being supported by the Alliance of Small Island States, actually through the Ministry of Energy and Security, I think, of Italy, who've basically, they're funding
of Italy?
So, yeah, Italy, I think, is part of its, you know, finance for... So there are ways in which, you know, global North countries are trying to push. And I think it's always interesting. I'm always like, hey, USA, hey, UK... Where are you at? So it's always interesting to think about, you know, who else can do that. And I think Italy deserves a, you know, some recognition for that. But I think that's the thing. It's one of the things where we had a total of 10 of us. Before, it used to only be four, so they just expanded it to 10 in the last 2 years. And so you get four people from the Caribbean, four people from the Pacific, and two from my region, Atlantic, Indian Ocean, South China Seas. And so we're based with the mission, and our missions, you know, I don't know how much people know about the embassies and stuff, but, you know, for you to have a mission to the UN, that's going to be its own thing, and then the embassy is going to be its own thing. In Seychelles, we have, and it's the same for most small island embassies, maybe six people who are doing these jobs, trying to follow everything in the UN, while also providing some services to, you know, Seychelles in New York or in the States. It's completely. So they're always overwhelmed in a sense. Wow. And we have to be very strategic. So by immediately having one person extra who has, and in terms of my case, about 5 years, but before they used to say, okay, 5 years, but 3 years of experience, you know, whether it's in international relations or law. So you get chosen in a sense to be at that mission as already someone who knows things and can put things into practice on behalf of your country and learn by doing. And really, we were lucky enough to have directors that were just expert in international environmental law. So they're really focused on climate change treaty before, but now it's expanded into the ocean and sustainable development. And, you know, for me, it was 2022 coming out of the pandemic. There were a lot of things for the super year for nature. I think it was that was the term it was given in the sense of what 2021 was meant to be. So 2022 was a big catch up. So a lot of things, just every month there was something new in terms of trying to figure out whether it's the UN Ocean Conference or whether it was, you know, COPs and substitute body meetings. So that's one thing that was really good, to just be based at UN headquarters, meeting all these other people from other islands, but all over the world, talking about these really big issues that affect us. And I think, you know, for me, in terms of how I got there, was a case of saying, okay, I had done about, at that point, about 4 years and a half of conservation in Seychelles, really had someone to guide me when I was doing projects or communications. And, you know, if you have that ability to do it at the local or even, you know, I would say grassroots level, it really helps you to go into the UN. It really goes into these places where you can be like, okay, I know what actually happens on that beach. I actually know what happens with that policy back home. And I know resources are missing, or we have these projects in the pipeline, all we need is this and that. And so it allows you to think about the big picture, but also bring something back to your community. I think that's essential.
I think the biggest thing I want to start with is, like, we're talking a lot about, like, the vulnerability of SIDS, and, you know, you've been at a global scale of understanding, like, who is getting the decision-making power over what is happening in those spaces and who's not, right? And you were talking about the beginning that these island states are 0.00001%, you know, responsible for what's happening with the climate crisis, yet are on, like, the front lines of facing the worst impacts of it. And so from your experience, like, what has it been like in those rooms? Like how do you, how, like, just if you could give us a little peek into, like, you know, are you feeling like people are actually paying attention? Has that shifted? What do you feel have been, like, the moments that have finally, like, brought SIDS to, like, a bigger point for people to really, like, care? I'm just curious from what you've observed.
Yeah, I mean, the fight for SIDS has been, you know, since before the beginning of the UNFCCC process, since before 1992. And so, you know, talking to others as well as being in the room, and these are closed rooms, right, for a reason. Right. The value of closed rooms is meant to be, oh, we're free to express ourselves. But it also can mean, I would call it racism, I would call it neocolonialism, and imperialism can take place.
And that part.
Yeah, yeah. So I was able to, you know, with the High Seas Treaty, so the Biodiversity Beyond National Jurisdiction Treaty, that was just agreed to in March and really starting to set off now. Palau is the first country to ratify it, which is great for SIDS, showing that we're leading, show that we're very much big ocean states. But, you know, I was involved with the last three intergovernmental conferences.
Yeah.
And this has been going on for 20 years. So I'm just like the young person in the room watching what's going on and seeing how Global North countries that make up 20% of the population, but are the only ones to go outside into this, you know, area that is about just under 50% of the world's surface area, right? When it comes down to trying to equitably share what might be out there, some countries never want that. They just don't want that. And that could be, they're talking about their companies needing to invest so much and be able to recuperate their investment. But we know how we've seen in pharmaceuticals, how that plays out, where, you know, prices are increased by 500% on particular drugs and all these things. So we see a lot of greed, I would say, a lot of imperialism at play. And in the climate space, It's really a case of like, okay, it's only small island developing states being impacted. Pakistan is a really good example for the loss and damage situation and that we found ourselves in for COP27. Mm. So there's a G77 and China, which is about 130 countries as a group. And within them, there's smaller groups. So AOSIS is one of those groups. The Africa group is another one. We'll have, you know, the Latin Americans. So it's a really big confluence of states. And it's hard for us to always agree on where we stand in different things. Some of us might be large oil producers, such as, you know, the ones in like Saudi Arabia, UAE. Others, you know, might be coastal island states. You know, we find ourselves in differences. But Pakistan basically experienced this terrible disaster, right? 30% of its land was flooded, mm-hmm. Billions in damages, you know, deaths, tolls, in too many to count. Mm-hmm. And I think at a very national level and at an international level, they said, hey, this is something we need to all get together now and really figure out on. And there's moments, I think, when people realize, yes, they're the first to go, but we're next, or our city's also on, like, you know, on the water. So when these commonalities are understood, people start getting together. And the problem is someone doesn't want to pay for all this damage. Mm-hmm. We know who's been polluting the longest, who's benefiting from that.
Yeah.
And we know that if you have enough money, you can maybe adapt out of it. You can build your own walls, build your own adaptation measures, right? And so other people do not want to pay for the damages we're facing, but did not cause.
Right.
And so that's always a big thing. So even if we have a loss and damage fund being established and created, and that's been a 30-year fight for it to be even on the table, that it's even a thing now.
Can you define that for people who might not know what the loss and damage fund is?
So loss and damage is a component of the treaties of the UNFCCC that's almost been silent in a sense. So you have mitigation, you reduce your emissions, you have adaptation, you adapt to what's going to happen, right? But loss and damage happens when you've exceeded adaptation, when you can no longer adapt anymore. Mm-hmm. And for small island developing states, especially when you think about Kiribati, Marshall Islands, Maldives, Tuvalu, you know, they are going underwater now. It's not by 2050.
Right.
It's not at 1.5C. We're at 1.1, 1.2. They're already having loss and damage. And that's things that are economic, right? We were talking about fisheries, but then how do you value culture? How do you value lives, identity? So these things are also being lost and damaged. And, you know, Prime Minister Mia Motley, she always says death, loss and damage to realize what we're talking about here. And so this fund, again, big, big thing that's been fought for, has always been said from the ones losing should be on the table, but the ones scared of pain or scared of accepting responsibility have always quashed it down. So now what we have is always going to be a compromise. It's a means by which the World Bank now has an oversight of a new fund. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that come a disaster, again, it's hard to know what a climate disaster is and what isn't. Attribution science is not there yet.
Yeah.
But come a disaster, big hurricane, something that's affected these countries, the idea is that there'll be quick access to this financing. And most importantly, additional. You know, a lot of what we've seen is with this big $100 billion pledge since 2009 is double counting. What the OECD says is $83 billion has been given from the Global North to the Global South. Oxfam will tell you it's actually something like under 25 billion.
Right.
Because loans are counted, or something that was meant to be for education or some other development thing is now being counted as climate. So there's all these accounting trickery. So this loss and damage fund is meant to be additional financing, not you taking from somewhere else to put it here, but something extra. And in a sense of, you know, what's the legal terms, it's not meant to be seen as compensation, but, you know, that's what's written on paper, and that's what's, and then what's happening in real life is a different story. I wouldn't want to go more deep in it, but it's something to definitely.
It's important,
follow.
Though.
Yeah.
Because it's at the root of it. I think it's a really big part of it, because when we're talking about countries' abilities to adapt to climate change, it comes down to following the money in a lot of ways. And I think the Loss and Damage Fund was, you know, a big victory in certain ways, and also just like, but like when it comes to implementation and actually holding, you know, these countries accountable that are polluting and destroying the planet, it's like, well, we're saying that they're being really slow and bureaucratic to put any dollars towards any of this.
I think that's the thing. It's all about, yes, it's the country's own interest. And then, you know, we talk about how many big fossil fuel lobbyists are in these things.
Oh,
and I think, you know, you can even see it at a domestic level within US politics. And I think what's interesting, when the Loss and Damage Fund was being thought about, it wasn't a case of, oh, we just donate $100 million here, or in this country's case, $17 million here, right? You maybe think of, you know, something like a Pigouvian tax. So basically say, okay, these fossil fuels, coal, oil, natural gas, they have so much impact. We're currently subsidizing these things by $600 billion. We should be more like taxing these things for the impact they do. And then whether it's, you know, domestically or whether it's internationally, what you raise from those taxes goes to into things like renewable energy or things like adaptation or things like loss and damage. And that's the issue. We talk about private sector and we talk about economic efficiency. When we have externalities so great, the market is not fulfilling the needs of the people of itself in the long run, maybe in the short term, but in itself, it doesn't make any economic sense because you're basically bailing out and subsidizing things that are damaging shareholder or stakeholder value, however you want to call it in a capitalist sense. But, you know, I don't want to come off as a commie. I definitely am not. But I think there's things about these things where you're like, cool, if the market was actually being regulated properly and done properly, we'd see money moving where it should be moving.
Right. But instead, it's like people that find holes and benefits and those holes in the system are going to benefit from it and then are going to frame it almost like, oh, like, well, we'll do that when that's convenient for us. But it's like ultimately you're eating your own tail.
Yeah, exactly.
But I want to know if you could speak a little bit more on your work towards work around deep sea mining, what you've been observing, and how that operates with this whole narrative around the commons and greedy people.
I think, you know, first of all, shout out to Sustainable Ocean Alliance. If it wasn't for the invitation to our ocean in Norway, and I met a couple of people, Mark Harver, some other really interesting people that we still keep in contact. And I have to admit, I had it completely wrong with deep sea bed mining. I thought it was something to do with oil and gas exploration, exploitation. And it was this is something Seychelles does in a sense, and it's quite interesting. We don't extract any oil at the moment, but it's something we've been exploring for a while, and it's a discussion. So my view, when I went to to Oslo and was sitting in these conferences, and I was thinking, deep sea bed mining, what does that mean? And then I really got a quick introduction to what that is, and I was like, this is crazy. Okay, and you know what's craziest is we're meant to have this green renewable revolution, but we don't do that by basically destroying the world's greatest carbon sink.
Right.
And I think, you know, so for me, being involved with SOA, being involved with several people, I realized, okay, Seychelles isn't currently looking into this, but doesn't have a position on this. Since this was about 2019, getting to 2020. And so it was an interesting topic to be like, we're very aware of other things that are going in the ocean when it comes to fishing, when it comes to this oil and gas exploration. But this is something on a national level we don't really pay attention to. And I think that's a discussion because at the end of the day, we're talking about things like the blue economy in Seychelles. We're a blue economy champion. And for me, the blue economy is meant to be analogous to the green economy. Mm. And in the green economy, we don't have extraction of fossil fuels. We don't have things where, unless it's greenwashing, we don't have things that are meant to be detrimental to our future, whether it's people, whether it's, you know, other forms of life born or yet to be born. And I think this is a discussion where I was like, okay, if we're talking about anything below 250 meters, nobody sees it. And we see things on land when it comes to mining that is atrocious, right? Whether it's, in human labor problems or human rights violations, but also a huge amount of ecological damage. And so in learning about this thing, I was like, okay, realizing that we do have a voice at Seychelles on blue economy, and we should be aware of this. And maybe we're not going to be the first country to be impacted by it, but we could be impacted by it. One of the zones that is an exploration, so the International Seabed Authority has given, I think, about 31 licenses to do, exploration and testing in terms of their things. And one of them is, I'd say about north of Seychelles is ocean territory. And what you realize is you can have plumes of material that's being moved from this ocean bed, the size of Jordan, as it was explained to me, shifting around and really get into your ocean, part of the ocean, right? Whoever owns the ocean, I don't know. But it goes back to this commons and, you know, this common heritage of humankind, as we can call it. It's one of these things where like, oh, what's going to impact here is going to come to me again. And it'll be like climate change. So, you know, for me, seeing that is like, I've been able to put the discussion in a national dialogue in Seychelles. We were able to identify a focal point in Seychelles to go to the International Seabed Authority. People like Sheena Tama, who is an amazing marine biologist, they're making sure that science is happening that is not related to this industry, that's, I think, more, you know, marine conservation related and focused, and bringing Seychelles along with her. She's a Seychelles leader when it comes to that, but ensuring that other people can go down to 250 meters, which, as you may know, like, is super hard to do, super expensive to do. And so, you know, these are the kind of things that I think when we're talking about the deep sea, we're like, yeah, this is somewhere very few people get to go, but it's the area where it's the largest area for life that can happen. It's this huge sink. And before we even get to know it, people are thinking about destroying it.
Yeah.
What's heartening, I guess, is there have been companies coming out saying, I think Google's one of them, saying, hey, we don't want any minerals coming from this. And, you know, when we start thinking about the circular economy, you know, there's a lot of studies that saying, look at our pounds of trash, our landfills, you know, mm-hmm. dumps. Look at how much precious minerals are going into these spaces, mm-hmm. and how at some point it will not only make sense, but it'll actually be profitable to take from there. So I think there are some entrepreneurs, some companies that are realizing, nope, we don't want to go into the deep sea. This is crazy. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of activism that's working to kind of show this is not going to work out. And I'm again, Sustainable Ocean Alliance comes out quite strongly for me. The Oxygen Project also comes out quite strongly for me in seeing people make noise about this, because not many people would hear about it otherwise. Not many people would care and catch on that this is going to impact us in so many ways that we don't know yet.
Yeah, definitely. So I want to get back to SIDS around the Loss and Damage Fund. That was viewed as, like, you know, one of the big wins in a lot of ways for a lot of these areas. Have there been other big wins that you've seen that have, like, given more power and voice to SIDS in, like, more global decision-making spaces?
Yeah, I mean, starting with the climate change space, I think this is the thing. Like, we know we're threatened by this in a way that others will be, but we're at the forefront of this. And I think what's interesting is seeing, maybe not always on paper, but seeing other countries, like the European Union usually negotiates as a bloc. And when we think back to this Loss and Damage Fund situation where it was on the table, but there was a lot of pushback from the Global North, you could see small countries in the EU break away and enforce things. So I think there's times where we learn when do we do things and how do they lead to success. That's something personally it's hard to explain, but you can see moments where, like, almost like a domino effect, where you see mm-hmm. more people are affected by this, more people realize they're in the same boat as us or the next boat where it's going to sink.
Mm-hmm.
There are some, I want to call it bilateral, or, you know, relationships that are being formed around countries. But it's hard to always say the success. As long as, you know, the parts per million keeps increasing, as long as we don't see new finance coming in, it's not easy to find hope.
Right.
I would say that's the climate change space. And, you know, I think we really see the operationalization Loss and Damage Fund being a big thing. And there's a lot of seats that have been given. You know, all countries need to sit on these things in a certain way, whether it's by region, and then it's, you know, in rotation.
Mm.
So smaller and developing states do have a seat on the Loss and Damage Board in that sense, and that will help us ensure that we help build this thing so that it also works for us. And I think that's important in terms of the governance of these frameworks or these institutions. Outside of the climate space, and think about the High Seas Treaty, again, so, you know, Seychelles and, you know, these Pacific islands, we have, you know, this tiny land area. So Seychelles' land area in total is about half the size of New York City, 175 square miles.
Wow.
And the rest, which is about 550,000, size of South Africa's landmass, you know, that's ocean. So we're these large, big, you know, giant ocean states. And so the High Seas Treaty is something where you see a lot of our territories border in the high seas.
Mm.
And I think just having a High Seas Treaty to begin with, it's not a speedboat, it's more like a raft, and waves may come and it will rock and will get wet, but it's a way in which we're saying, okay, this is an issue for the world. It's the first time we've talked about the conservation and sustainable use of the ocean.
Mm.
When we're talking about deep seabed mining, the International Seabed Authority, that's also part of what we call the UN Convention on Law of the Sea.
Mm.
And there's things like fisheries that have come out of that, and deep seabed mining is coming out. So this is the first time the world has sat there and said, conservation and sustainable use of this area.
Mm.
And so there's been a lot of compromises. There's been a lot of things that when you're dealing with 193 countries who have them, which we are, to agree to these things is hard, but we're saying, okay, now let's think about capacity building, transfer of technology that would allow us to go out there, but beyond that, actually go into our own waters as well. Because if we're being helped to go beyond 200 nautical miles of our islands, we'll also be building capacity within that. And I think it'll take some while for countries to ratify, so you need about 60 countries to ratify.
Mm.
But once the first COP happens for this, once And this is going to take years. It just does. I expect to see finance moving into small and developing states. I expect to see capacity strengthening, but also a sense of understanding that we're good partners for this. So it could be a sense where, like in Seychelles and Mauritius, another small island developing state, the Greenpeace went out to this area called the Saya de Maya Bank, and they found a seagrass meadow the size of Switzerland.
What?
And so this is something that is, you know, we don't know what's out there in a sense, and how do we manage these things? But
that's crazy.
It's crazy. And so, you know, when we think about sequestration, when we think about all the other value this thing brings to yeah. us, but even itself, if we're empowered to manage these places and in a sense benefit at a region level, but also at a global level, I think this will help us in many ways. And that's kind of like the ground floor. We still need to build the first floor, second, and all that.
Right.
But it exists rather than it not existing.
That's really interesting. I didn't know much about the High Seas Treaty before, you know, researching your work and everything. And I think it's like a really good starting point of a conversation, because humanity in general has barely scratched the surface of understanding the ocean and what it brings to us, and also like how communities that are very dependent on you know, their own coastlines for like survival and habitability, like, you know, how do you build policies around that when you share waters with other people? It's complex.
And you know, I've got to give hats off to, you know, the Pacific Islander negotiators. I mean, it's such a far distance to come, and you know, they always come with the most humble fastidious lawyers and, you know, people with knowledge, whether it's scientists, whether it's traditional. And so seeing them fight for their rights and for their recognition, and obviously we feel a certain way to the ocean, but I have to say, as a Seychelles, I don't feel the 11,000 years of culture that the Pacific Islanders have. You know, this is something we look to and we're like, wow, these people have lived with the ocean, traveled along it long before anything we know of. And so it's really interesting to see them win a treaty that I think by all means and purposes should be looking to them to how they manage, how we manage the ocean. So I think there's a lot of things in there, and I think that's the thing. And this is, I'm not a lawyer by any training, but I've been exposed to this. But it's what's interesting with all these international treaties is the more you have the same principles coming out. So, you know, a lot of people will be familiar with the polluters pays principle and all these things. So we're trying to make the special circumstances of small island states are really something that's understood across the climate change space, across the ocean space, sustainable development space. And with this High Seas Treaty, again, our special circumstances within the ocean space was understood and accepted. And so it's kind of a very legal, minutia kind of detail, but we hope this is going to allow us, when it comes, you know, to understanding what we are facing and what we can bring to the table, you know, more countries understand that, more other people understand that, the better.
Yeah, and it's because it, yeah, like you said, it is like special circumstances. It is very unique conditions where like one thing goes wrong and your entire, like everything collapses. It's
very fragile.
Yeah, it's very fragile. Like it's not, there's not some like backup, you know?
Can't just go to, you can't go from New York to New Jersey and say, help me out. No, there's
no,
it's like 3 days by boat for, you know, like a couple hours by plane.
Right. I think people don't even like, can't even conceptualize that, because if you're not from there, it's like, why would you think of that? I was curious about your work with the Seychelles Island Foundation and just like some of like the wins or like the big accomplishments like you were able to achieve in that role.
Yeah, I mean, I was super lucky enough to, you know, take a unplanned gap year where I ended up working for SIF for the first time on Aldabra Atoll. So it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site that's about, you know, 3-4 hours by plane from Seychelles' main islands. And you see humpback whales, you know, breach. So you see this 25-ton animal, you know, slam into the water. You see flamingos. There's only 2 oceanic flamingo populations. About 120 to 150,000 giant tortoises. You know, these things are like 500 pound. So my journey with SIF started really, you know, when I was like 19, 20. And I, after finishing, you know, my bachelor's, I went back and worked with them as a project manager. And, you know, so I was really lucky enough to have a mentor, Dr. Frauke Fleischer-Dogle. So she was someone you can find many people, I think, who are young, who've looked at this person, and she's given us the responsibility, but also given guidance. And so as a manager, I was able to work in invasive alien species, so trialing out ways in which we could deal with things like these things called yellow crazy ants, but also things like invasive vegetation. So that was a first little project that was really getting an idea of what does project management mean. Mm. But it's also talking about policy, not only for Seychelles, but in the ocean, and how we use technology and think about technology when it comes to policy. Mm. After that, I was going for the Aldabra Cleaner project. So that project was about 18 months of, like, 90% of it was like on Mahé, instead of just either preparing for it, fundraising about $250,000. And about 5 weeks of that was actually being on Aldabra and removing about 25 metric tons of pollution.
Wow.
And so that was about 12 of us dedicated, you know, volunteers coming from, six coming from Seychelles, or including myself, seven coming from Seychelles and six coming from the UK. And we had done this partnership with the University of Oxford. And so we not only removed this 25 metric tons, but raised awareness on it, started to do, you know, an analysis of where this stuff was coming from. Mm. And I think, you know, there's an interesting discussion, right? If you're in the Indian Ocean and it's easy for me to say, hey, Philippines, this is your trash.
Right.
But actually, you know, that's the tiniest of information. We know where that trash is coming to,
right,
it being important in the Philippines. Worse than that, we know that actually when by weight, it's fishing gear. Mm-hmm. And going back to fishing, it's one where we say there's these Spanish or French industrial fisheries on the high seas or on our territory, and they just dump or cut off nets and all these other ghost gears. So we find out actually in our global south neighborhood, actually it's not us really killing or our neighbors killing us or making us feel this plastic pollution impact. It's the fisheries coming down, and we found about 83% by weight of what was on Aldabra is coming from the fishing industry.
Oh my God.
So it's interesting when we start getting science, you know, because we're doing current analysis, we're trying to understand. It's easy for people to first think, oh, this was dumped from Kenya, this was dumped from India, this came from that. And that is, yes, that is part of the discussion. But it's interesting when you get into science, you realize, oh no, actually, this is a huge beyond regional issue. Mm-hmm. And so that was something that I was really happy to co-lead. And it was something that led to a policy shift in Seychelles. Now there's these things called fish aggregating devices. So, you know, these are things used that are unsustainable in many ways because they mostly target juvenile tuna. And if you target the young before they reproduce, the population doesn't grow. But they also just ended up on these protected areas carrying on fishing, carrying damage on damaging corals. And so there's a lot of push by other youth, by NGOs in Seychelles in the region to say, let's ban this. Mm. And so it's not banned yet, but they've been forced to remove some of these things. They've been forced to come up with biodegradable. So there's some pressure on something, because I think industry or governments, when they operate in the dark, they feel they can get away with anything. But the second, you know, you start saying, actually, this is your trash. Actually, this is your problem. You caused this. They can ignore you for only so long, I think. So the Aldabra Cleaner Project, you know, working with volunteers, working with really dedicated scientists and everyday kind of people really showed me, hey, this is when people with a bit of strategy, with a bit of planning, a lot of determination, we can actually get these things to be looked at. And I think it's contributing things to things like the plastic treaty that, you know, where there wasn't science in places like Aldabra dealing with plastic pollution, now there is. Or what small island developing states are saying about plastic pollution, you know, that's contributed to that. I've also been lucky enough, you know, again, through SIF to take part in Seychelles' marine spatial plan. So we protect about 32% of our economic exclusion zones. That's about something the size of Germany. So about 15% of that is no take, and about 15%, again, 70% of that is sustainable use.
That's so cool.
Which is, yeah, it's cool, but it's really, what's the word? Like, as a young person, I hope other people get that chance as well. And I think that's
right.
Because we're seeing it built, but if we're not building, how do we maintain it? How do we understand it? So I think that's where young people and everyday people need to be brought into that process.
Yeah, it sounds like you were put on a very unique journey with like a unique set of, you know, certain things to like get to the pathway to be able to do that kind of work. Yeah, like where do you feel there is like skills gaps that exist like to really like be able to empower like the next generation, especially in SIDS?
I think there's a lot of education awareness, but effective science communication or effective communication in general, right? And I think this is what I like about what you do. And it's one of the things where you need to really engage people. You know, it has to be exciting. I mean, I remember going to these conferences and say, you know, if we're going to talk about ocean or we're going to talk about nature, there should be an element of discovery. There should be an element of exploration. We should also be thinking about, do people earn money from this? You know, if we think about careers as you do, you know, we can't all be volunteers in this space. We need to find a way in which we can pay the bills and aspire to live in some level of comfort. And I think that that skills gap is something that's really interesting to talk about. In somewhere like Seychelles, you know, very few people actually dive or snorkel. And not much more swim. So if we're going to talk about things like the ocean, or if we're going to, you know...
That's wild.
And I think that's the
so
thing.
So they live on an island, but then they don't actually swim or snorkel and dive.
And you see that, I think you see that in the States and with people of color, you see in the Caribbean.
Right.
And I think there's a lot of discussion. So there's a really cool NGO a nonprofit I've been exposed to, Black in Marine Science. And I think
BIMS.
BIMS is... So I think it's really interesting when you start bringing people in the ocean and say, hey, we know why we're afraid of this based on legacy and history, and we should respect this, but this could be our future. This can be our playground. This can be our livelihood. And I think that's what's interesting. I think sometimes there's a lot of high skills in a sense, but swimming shouldn't be one of those high skills or inaccessible skills. And I think for an islands, I think that's important for our governments and school systems to realize, let's get people in the ocean, let's keep them safe, but let's make sure they have fun and explore. And I think that's when someone sees something, they'll care for it. And if they see that thing is being destroyed, they'll learn about it. They'll fight for it. And so I think that's just a very foundational level. Mm. But I think, you know, there's a lot of things where, going back to the communication, is do we just say acronyms and weird policy words, or do we try and like really talk about it? And so the analysis is key, but really saying, I understand that I may have had a month to read this paper, but now let me make it digestible for somebody who only has 5 minutes. Right. And I think if we can make that happen more and more, people will look at us less crazy and say, okay, actually this affects me and I want to do something about it.
That's interesting.
I'm currently doing, so the master's I'm currently doing now, it's interesting. I've done about 6-7 years in total in the nonprofit and government sector work. I'm thinking of a private sector world after this. And the skill set I'm looking at is things like ESG, so environmental social governance. Mm-hmm. And it sounds a little tricky because I think, you know, you have to be really careful about who you're working for, what integrity they have or don't have.
Right.
And so I'm interested to see, like, at the end of the day, I've seen what governments and nonprofits can do, and I've never really been in the shoes of the private sector.
Mm-hmm.
And as a rounding off for 10 years, I think, okay, let me not always see them as the bad guys, quote unquote. Let me see how it actually works, because the money or the ability to move fast with this crisis, most governments aren't able to, most NGOs aren't able to, or at least at a very small level.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm able to go into a larger corporate structure or something else that I'm not familiar with when it comes to the private sector, we can see maybe some emissions change, or we can see some financing going somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's an interesting discussion, because there's a lot of skills there when we're talking about, you know, greenhouse gas inventory accounting,
mm-hmm.
or things like life cycle assessments, or things like economics and these things.
Mm-hmm.
So I think these are things that, being an environmentalist, for quote unquote, whatever that might mean,
mm-hmm.
you find yourself dealing with a lot more people, a mm-hmm. lot more business sometimes, and being able to manage that and be able to have a good judge of
mm-hmm.
what is a reliable business, what is a sustainable business.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's also something I'm figuring out for myself as I go through this course and as I look for jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Because I do think I will end up back in government in Seychelles, but in trying to understand this problem, trying to go to the source of the problem, the skill set of being in the business world is essential, because mm-hmm. they're either going to be either your allies or your enemies for life.
Yeah, I mean, I think also when it comes to understanding political lobbying and decision making and who gets to like fund decision makers, it's really important, again, to follow the money.
Yes.
I think if I've learned anything through the Brown Ogren podcast and all the content I've done over the years, is following the money, because you have to understand that to understand like why this system has gotten broken in the first place.
Yep.
Who are the actors that get the power and the influence versus not? And how do you, you know, be able to pull levers in some ways to be able to like, yeah, resource the communities you care about, you know?
And it's a strategy.
And luckily, like, you have that grounding of coming from the background and the root in your culture and things like that. And I think that like that in some ways, you know, creates that balance, because like otherwise you'll just be lost in like dystopia. Yeah, for people that, you know, want to learn more about SIDS and want to get involved in this work that maybe aren't working at a UN level, but just want to educate themselves, do you have lists of like any books, resources, organizations that you'd want to plug?
That's a really good one. I think, you know, a lot of these organizations are on Instagram. So like the Alliance of Small Land States does actually like have a X or Twitter feed and an Instagram feed. So I think it's always interesting, especially during COPs or other high level, like the UN General Assembly or, you know, World Oceans Day. It'll be interesting to see what they're posting. And usually now we've got the Pacific who are leading. So currently Samoa and Palau next. And so following those are really, I think it's good to show that people are following these things and understanding, because You'll find small land developing states on the side of science and evidence, mm-hmm. because that's just where we stand in terms of what we have to lose. In terms of these member states and independent states, you know, we have a presence at the UN. But then I think about Puerto Rico, I think about Hawaii, I think of other countries like the Netherlands who have overseas territories like, you know, Aruba, Curaçao. And so it's always interesting. And I've met a lot of these islanders. They're just islanders, right? Mm. They experience the same problems we've experienced.
Mm-hmm.
And so thinking about how their governments are on the wrong side of histories and they are kind of through a colonial, I don't know, imperialist kind of legacy, right? They're not represented by their governments at these. And a lot of, you know, people of color, you know, those people who are facing environmental justice, they're not being represented by this government. So it's interesting to see, okay, these islands or people within, you know, these global north countries, for quote unquote words, it's interesting to see how we can find islands at home or find mm-hmm. islanders at home and say, actually, we're going to pay attention to this
mm-hmm.
problem in Hawaii. We're going to pay attention to this problem in Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
And because they're not only a part of, you know, they're not only islanders and they're like Seychelles or whatever, but they're part of the US and they need to have representation. And their representation is not just beneficial for themselves in a mm-hmm. sense, but also beneficial for me as someone concerned about the climate. So I think finding allies within our countries and saying, yeah, these people are similar to what we're seeing in other small island developing states. Mm-hmm. I think that's something of quite, and I have a lot of passion for the people who, you know, they want to talk, but they can't talk. And so I think being able to find alliances with civil society, we have a lot of civil society organizations based in the global north that are always on the side of SIDS. And you always have to manage your agenda
because mm-hmm.
you want your agenda set by a country, not by an NGO. But it's about these allyship that's a really key thing. So those are some of my thoughts about it. But yeah, AOSIS is definitely worth a shout out. And I think, you know, there's the fellowship program that's happening every year. So if you're someone from, you know, a small island developing state, whether it's the Pacific, Caribbean, Atlantic, Indian Ocean, South China Seas, you can basically or know someone who's like that, definitely send them the way to AOSIS because it's a great opportunity to, you know, build your capacity, learn what's going on at the international level.
And how can people connect with you?
I'm Turtle Commuter on Instagram. I'm on LinkedIn as Jeremy Langdon.
Turtle Commuter.
Yeah, I used to, for science, used to jump on turtles, and I promise it was only for science. So,
okay.
And, I think, yeah, at some point if you're not careful, you may jump on a turtle that's a bit too bigger than you and they get dragged along. But it was for DNA sampling and
everything.
So I promise, do not start jumping on turtles.
No, in the making of that handle. That's so funny. And I guess a last question is, what gives you hope in the face of so much uncertainty of the world these days?
Yeah, I think I find myself not alone. I find, like, in the program I'm doing or just generally talking to people like yourself and others, you know, there are a lot of people who care and not just say they care, but act accordingly. I think
yeah.
when how we consume and how we organize, what we decide to do as a 9-to-5. So I think that's like, you know, it would be a whole lot worse if nobody was ever in small island developed states in our life. Sometimes you go into somewhere and it's like, and then you're like, oh damn, yeah, we don't matter, it doesn't. And so I don't see that on a day-to-day basis. I see people are interested and engaged. I think for me, and it's hard in a concrete jungle like New York City to do this, but being able to go out to nature. So when I was in Seychelles, I was making sure, you know, I was doing a hike, snorkeling. So I always find myself after a couple hours in nature to be kind of, what's the word, reminded of its resilience sometimes and how little we don't expect it to be so resilient. We underestimate it. So there's times I'm seeing things happen and I'm like, how did that plant grow there? Or how did that species of, you know, birds still be chirping when there's, you know, right next to the highways? So there's moments when you just go out in nature and observe it and feel for yourself. You're like, okay, this thing's still going to some extent. And you might see a lot of depressing things. You might see a lot of things that just kind of, throw you off and make you feel insignificant, but there's nothing like walking to a massive tree and seeing, oh, this thing's been here 50, 100 years, you know, what, you know, it's somehow still here. There's still somehow a way for this to exist. And that reminds me of things I've seen in Seychelles where, for Aldabra, for instance, they used to exploit green turtles to a point where they were not seeing them on the beach at all. But after 40 years of conservation, they saw a 500% increase.
Mm.
And so it's kind of like the liver, you know, you need like maybe like 15-20% of it and it'll grow back.
Mm.
So I think going to nature and seeing that sometimes is just important for yourself.
Amazing. Well, On that note, we'll wrap the episode, but super appreciative of you joining the show today, sharing your perspectives on the Seychelles and all the small island developing states, the SIDS out there. And so for people listening, I think what I gained from this is it's really important to acknowledge that there are these small island developing states that exist that are fighting day in, day out to protect their, you know, economies and ecosystems and communities. And it's important to just inform yourself on where these places are located. Try to donate and support those organizations. Continue to advocate if you work on a more global climate level to understand the loss and damage fund and continue to advocate. And ultimately, we want to continue to address and keep below the 1.5 degrees Celsius threshold because every degree matters, especially for places like SIDS. So thank you all so much for listening to the Brown Girl Green podcast. I'm Christy Drutman, and I interview environmental leaders and advocates about justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion, as well as creative solutions to the climate crisis. Thank you, and check out the next episode.